In tonight's episode, we discuss The Raven from the makers of That's So Raven. Welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin again.
You may notice that my voice sounds a little different. I have a cold.
That's right. Dan's going through the change.
Yep. So, guys, how much sexier does my voice sound right now? Like 40%?
Well, for people who find 60%. Sickness sexy.
Well, when you're staring at me like you are right now, it's like a million percent.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
That's good now. Lean closer, yep.
Flophouse, come into your ear holes.
Mess up your hair a little bit more.
Right. So for anyone who has a contamination fetish, Dan sounds sexier to you right now.
But my cold cannot dampen my spirits because you know what? It's my favorite time of the year.
What time is that,
Fourth of July? Sukkot, which is right now. No. Well, it just ended. Sorry, Dan. What did you do for Simchat Torah?
No, that's not it. It's Shocktober, everyone.
Chain rattles. Lightning.
Boogan,
skeleton bones.
Boogans.
It's the holiest month on the Flophouse calendar. And
the only month, as far as I'm concerned, on the Flophouse calendar. Man.
That's the month that we watch a slightly higher percentage of horror movies than we would in a normal month.
Yep.
It's like it's the one month of the year that the sun is actually shining for me. Mm-hmm. Every other month, 11 months of the year, it's dim and cloudy and the leaves are rattling against the windows.
I mean, that sounds like Shocktober to me.
Sounds like what October is for everybody else.
But tonight we watched a movie. I wouldn't call it a horror movie per se, but it has horror themes.
I would call it a suspense thriller.
Mm-hmm.
Like a classy horror movie.
It's got
literary overtones.
Yeah, a macabre touch. And that movie.
Yep, McCorn on the macabre.
That's a good one, dude.
Thank you. AV Club, put it up top. McCorn on the macabre.
Old Elliot Quotables Kalin over here.
Mm-hmm. It's his notable quotable for tonight.
Oh, there'll be more.
This movie was called The Raven, after the Edgar Allan Poe poem of the same name.
Not the bird of the same name?
So it was just, like a film adaptation of a story?
Film adaptation of many Edgar Allan Poe stories.
Like a mash-em-up?
Filtered through the laziest possible way to tell a story about a historical figure. Have them solve a series of crimes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, this was a...
That's probably been done before a lot, right?
Yeah, George Washington P.I., Abraham Lincoln Crook Finder, Martin Van Buren Crime Stopper, a lot of president stories. Let's not forget Detective Napoleon. And, of course...
Oh, just one more question.
And, of course, Edison and Chimp. The one where he taught a chimp how to solve crimes with him.
Was this an electronic chimp or?
No. It was just regular Edison, regular chimp. Jack Klugman played Edison. Tony Randall played the chimp. It was their follow-up to The Odd Couple. But yeah, so the basic premise of this movie is that somebody is committing murders in Baltimore in the late 1840s.
Nobody has ever committed a murder in Baltimore. That's the thing.
Well, he started it. So everyone who enjoyed The Wire, you're welcome.
Yeah.
You can thank this movie for starting the trend of murders in Baltimore.
The Baltimore murder fad that continues to this day.
But here's what makes the murders different than your regular gang banging. Each murder, it takes the form of a play on a different Edgar Allan Poe story, and so Edgar Allan Poe is forced to investigate. You would think to clear his name, but that gets dropped pretty quickly. No one really thinks he did it. But he and a very
he's too much of a weakling drunkard.
Yes, he is a drunk, crazy person, except he's really only drunk and crazy in one scene establish that, and then he's pretty sedate for most of it. But he makes a deal with a police detective. I'm going to help you solve these crimes. Then his fiancée is kidnapped. Bum, bum, bum.
What?
He gets a note from the murderer, and it says, you have to solve these crimes and write original Edgar Allan Poe stories around each new murder, or else I will kill your fiancée. And at the end of it, I'll reveal her location or whatever.
Talk about a killer fan, huh?
Except for all of the
guys.
Boom.
Yeah. Except for
put Stuart up on the quotes board. That's one for Elliot, one for Stuart, zero for Dan.
Night's still young. You can change that, Dan.
Except all of the murders that the murderer does are already based on Edgar Allan Poe's stories. So the stories that Poe writes are stories that are based on murders that are based on his
That's the problem with being an artist is people just want you to keep turning out the same shit, you know? They don't want you to, like, push the envelope.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is
like
based...
The Raven 2 coming, I assume, next fall.
I don't think so. I think it's actually based in historical fact. Near the end of his life, Edgar Allan Poe released special editions of each of his stories. Mm. So it was like, instead of the Telltale Heart, it was the Telltale Heart with little robots flying around in the background.
Sure, CGI.
And there was the one where
Fortunato
tried to wall up Montressor first.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the one where Mask of the Red Death went, no! Actually, I guess that wasn't a special edition. That was just a prequel.
It was pretty special. I mean, he really wanted the heart and the Telltale Heart to be like squirting blood like right into your eyeballs.
But they didn't have the technology to do that in a story at the time. So he had to release the Telltale Heart, the special edition.
Sure.
Then they put back in the scene where the guy who kills his mentor in the Telltale Heart talks to Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah.
Using the old footage.
And it was tough because, like, at that point he would have stepped on Jabba the Hutt's tail, so...
They had to write it in. Had to write it in.
Mm-hmm. With some awesome eye-bulging out effects.
So, basically...
Literary effects, I mean.
What we have is a race against time as Edgar Allan Poe and this very bland captain, police inspector guy...
Who is it? That guy from Luke Evans from... he was one of the Musketeers.
So, yeah, right? Stuart recognized him from Three Musketeers.
Flophouse fave.
Another literary classic made better by including crazy stuff that didn't exist at the time. This is another one of those movies where it's the 1840s, but the policeman knows all about forensics and... is all CSI all over everything. But it's a race against time, and if they were the audience, they would know pretty early on who the killer was, but they're not the audience. They're the movie, so it takes them a while to figure it out. Should I go into more detail about the different murders?
Well, I mean, you can just
or just say the end through. Of the movie?
I mean, we can get back to the murders. I guess, yeah, just skip to the end.
Well, you get to the end, and you think for a second it's the Edgar Allan Poe thinks that the murderer was his newspaper editor.
Which would make sense. His newspaper editor is the closest to the motive, having a motive.
Because
the
sales have gone up since these stories have started. And it's a good red herring. That's a fine red herring. And Edgar Allan Poe discovers his body sitting at the editor's body, sitting at the editor's desk with his wrists just kind of skeletonized. I didn't really quite understand what happened to him there.
Weird.
It was like someone had slashed his wrist and they just kept going until there was just twine connecting his hand and his arm. And then it turns out that the villain was... the typesetter, who you saw in the background of a couple shots.
I totally knew it. I called it, right?
I don't remember you calling it. Maybe. You actually thought it was his fiancé's dad's manservant.
That's where
he has a really sinister mustache.
But there's so many mustaches in the movie.
This is where the stereotype of the bloodthirsty typesetter comes from.
And frankly, as a member of the Typesetter Anti-Defamation League, I'm tired of it.
Yeah.
For too long, typesetters have been typecast as murderers,
like
when fully 25% of typesetters are not murderers. So for that one quarter of typesetters who have never tasted human blood or quenched their thirst to worship the Ebon goddess.
Unlike the raccoon that
Edgar Allan Poe's
character keeps.
Oh, Edgar Allan Poe also has a pet raccoon who at one point he's dissecting a human heart on his desk and the raccoon, and I guess the raccoon's just nibbling at it or whatever. So that raccoon,
yeah, I mean,
you have to
assume
is...
eat the whole thing. It takes a while.
Well, no.
It's just thick tissue.
And then also Poe tosses him like a quarter of that heart to eat.
Yeah.
So he's just like, well, I have this heart.
Yeah, only a quarter, though. The rest is for later.
Taste the human flesh.
It was the taste of that hideous heart. You take it, raccoon.
Turned out the raccoon was the killer at the end.
That would have been great. Well, Edgar Allan Poe, I'm tired of living as your pet. Now you've been mine. Game of cat and mouse, or rather, raccoon and man.
Maybe they were expecting an orangutan to be the murderer.
Orangutan. There's no G at the end of orangutan.
Wow. Who would have thought that two flop houses in a row, we would have a legitimate reason for saying orangutan.
Yeah, I only hope that Shocktober continues in this fashion, and we go and we watch next the orangutan murders. Someone is killing orangutans, and it's up to a kid and a magic bike to find out who.
Turns out it's the bonobo.
We could always watch the recently released Every Which Way But Loose, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Recently released.
I mean, geologically, it was very recently released. Sure. It's an eye blink on the geologic scale.
Oh, man.
So there's a bunch of murders, and he catches the murderer.
In his last story, he said to the murderer, the hero of that story offers his life in exchange for his beloved's, and the murderer accepts it. And the typesetter goes, "No, you can't, no," which is a pretty good way to tip off that he's the murderer. Edgar Allan Poe goes back to the newspaper office, finds out it's the typesetter. The typesetter says, "Well, isn't that the offer, your life for hers?" and gives Edgar Allan Poe some poison to drink. Poe drinks it. The murderer leaves, and Poe finds that there's a trapdoor in the floor of the publishing house, which leads to...
Telltale Heart style,
TTHS, which leads to an evidence dungeon in which they're in the floor. His
America's
fiance...
first evidence dungeon, as you pointed out.
Yeah, but it's now a tourist attraction.
Yeah, there's a plaque there from the Historic Preservation Committee.
The first stupid serial killer was here.
Until this point, serial killers scattered their evidence all over the place so that they wouldn't get caught. But then Reynolds decided to change that.
Collect it all for a policeman to find, or perhaps an author.
And Edgar Allan Poe finds his fiancée, saves her, but then dies before being able to fully communicate the identity of the killer to the police detective. And
he dies in a fashion fitting historical evidence.
Well, I mean, he dies sitting on a park bench in the cold, which is not so different. I mean, the story...
Did he die in like a ditch in the
real story
life?
I heard was that he was found in a gutter and was in some kind of stupor and was taken to the hospital and died. But, there's a couple different conflicting stories. I don't remember which one is totally true.
Poor guy. Poor drunk.
Yeah. Poor drunky McPoe. But then the typesetter had said, "Have you heard of this new writer in Paris, Jules Verne? He's pretty good." So the next last scene is the typesetter gets off his train in Paris, gets off his ship in Paris.
And the audience is like, "Oh, here we go
here
again.
Here comes the sequel, The Raven 2, The Nautilus." The criminal gets into a stagecoach. The detective is there and shoots him because the detective, I guess...
It's more of a hansom cab than a stagecoach. I mean, we are in Paris, the Old West.
That cab wasn't that
the killer,
handsome.
The killer jumps toward the detective, cut to black. The shot rings out and the bullet hits a pane of glass for some reason.
And then there's a...
Shattering glass CGI effect.
Shattering glass themed end credit sequence. Because
like it's
movies,
a Bond movie, apparently.
Well, but that's because that's... I remember, I think High Fidelity, another John Cusack movie, was the first one I remember seeing this in, where they had a full end credit sequence after the movie that looked like it was meant to be the opening credit sequence, and they just decided, it's just going to take up time. Why bother? We'll put it at the end. And now you almost never see... Or not almost never, but you very rarely see elaborate opening credit sequences, like on the Bond movies you do. But often you will see elaborate closing credit sequences, and like I don't understand what the
reasoning
was.
And when you do see it, it seems to be it's a cause for concern or whatever.
What, when you see it at the beginning?
Yeah, like the girl with the dragon tattoo had a really elaborate opening sequence.
Oh, I didn't
sequence,
know. I still haven't seen that.
And you know
that. Why is that a
happens.
Cause for concern?
Yeah, like Casino Royale is a really
like
elaborate
movie.
Opening credit
yeah,
sequence.
Yeah, the Spider-Man movies. Have elaborate opening sequences.
Yeah, a lot of web effects.
Uh-huh.
I think it's funny, though, as you pointed out, like, the typesetter is like, "Jules Verne, his works remind me a little bit of yours, Mr. Poe." And it's like, how? How do
they're
they...
totally different.
They're all about fucking murders, right?
I mean, they're yeah. Tales of the Fantastic, I
Jules,
suppose.
I mean, well, that's the thing. If he had said, "They remind me of yours, not your more famous murder stories, but your less famous ballooning and science fiction hoaxes." Because Edgar Allan Poe did write, like, he wrote a story called, I think, A Month in a Balloon or something like that. Or maybe that's the Verne one. He wrote a story about a balloonist. A lot of Edgar Allan Poe's stories were like,
The Telltale Balloon.
It's called The Balloons in the Room Morgue. A lot of his stories were like hoaxes that could be considered very early science fiction that you would print in the newspaper kind of pretending if they were real or not. So in a way, the theme of like him printing stories based on real murders in the newspaper is a clever one, but they don't do it well enough.
But yeah, but I mean, it's just like the killer being fixated on Poe makes sense as it's written, but then him being fixated on Jules Verne doesn't make sense. Like, I'm going to go and I'm going to carry out some steampunk murders in France.
It's almost like they were like, maybe this movie will make a lot of money. We'll have a sequel with steampunk murders. Nah, we'll just kill him at the end.
So,
have you heard of this Charlie Dickens?
So do you think the movie could have been any better if they'd made an effort to just have it be like, there's a guy murdering people in Baltimore and Edgar Allan Poe gets wrapped up in it because, you know, he writes, you know, murder stories or whatever, instead of murders that are specifically about stories he's written?
Well, I like the idea of I think they should have kept, not that the murders are based on stories he's written, but maybe that he still has to write – he still gets the challenge to write stories based on them. I like the idea of a killer who is a fan of the author but and wants to inspire his hero to write new stories because his hero has writer's block. But it's still just such a lazy thing to like, Edgar Allan Poe's life was really fascinating. He was dogged by depression and melancholy. He came up with some of the most frightening and original visions in American weird literature. We'll have him solve some crimes. Like, we'll just have him fight a serial killer or some shit.
And, well, but also having him solve these crimes that are based on his murders or his tales, like, it plays into that played-out trope of the serial killer who is so super powerful that he can arrange all these crazy cat-and-mouse games. Like, if he was just pretty a murderer.
He's just a regular, klutzy serial killer. Always making mistakes, getting his foot caught in a chamber pot.
No, but I mean, he's a serial killer who, like, was obsessed with Poe, that's one thing. But if he's going to, like, set up a huge fucking pendulum with a razor on it, then no one noticed that he, like, he imported these gears.
I will. We should talk about he had those forged. we should talk about the murders, but I will say I'm glad they didn't go the route of, like, a Shakespeare in Love type thing where it's like, these are the real-life murders that inspired Poe's greatest tales, you know, and they've been hidden from people's view for all this time or some nonsense. But
you're right. That would have been shittier.
But let's talk the murders. So the first murder is based on Murder in the Rue Morgue. There's a lady with her throat cut and another lady who's dead stuffed in a chimney, just like in Murder in the Rue Morgue. Makes you think there's going to be an orangutan. There isn't.
Disappointed. I'm already kind of mad.
Next murder. Is that the pendulum one?
It is an
enormous, crazy Sherlock Holmes movie pendulum. Like, it's a Wild Wild West giant gears pendulum.
Yeah, he like fucking built the like archway for the pendulum with bricks and stuff.
Like, it's totally crazy and huge. But the pendulum scene is kind of fun because it slashes through that guy's belly a lot.
Yeah, like it goes through the belly more times than you would expect.
I think blood splatters all over the camera at least.
You would expect it to go through his belly like two times, maybe three, but it goes through at least five times.
And he's been slashed in half a couple times, and he's still like, ah, grr, ah. He has amazing fortitude.
I might be able to do it still.
And one of the reasons they think Poe is involved in some way is because the second victim is a literary critic that Poe had a rivalry with through the newspapers. So it's not like there's a very brief moment when the police think maybe Poe did this. But then they just change.
They meet him and they're like, he's kind of a turd, probably didn't do it.
Yeah, he's kind of a weakling. Then
there's one that's going to be based on the Mask of the Red Death, but that's a red herring to cover up the kidnapping of Elizabeth.
His fiance Elizabeth, her father throws a big masked ball, and the guy.
Where everyone is Harlequins and such.
Her father, played by Brendan Gleeson, using probably the hokiest Balmer accent I've ever heard.
All the accents are all over the place in this movie, and I'm glad not everybody did an English accent. But since by the 1840s, people didn't really in America had different accents.
Yeah, but Cusack is definitely doing like a half English thing.
I don't know. I think he's just doing a more mannered version of his own voice.
That's old timey.
Yeah. He's just doing old timey. Yeah. And one thing that is irritating is there's like a bar fight, and as soon as it starts, cue that Irish fiddle music. It's the 19th century. There's no music that exists except Irish fiddle. And look, I like Irish fiddle music. I like fiddle music in general. It's fast-paced. It gives a lot of energy to a scene.
Uh-huh.
But
it's good for a brawl.
It's good for a brawl. Yeah. But every 19th century thing you see, it's shot in the same color palette of like of like dank greens and golden browns, and it has Irish fiddle music.
Well, that was, they didn't have bouncers back then. All they knew is that music had charms to soothe the savage beast.
So it's like, there's a fight breaking out. Quick, play that fiddle.
Exactly.
Actually, it's pretty accurate. That probably is the kind of thing that
they did. I think in the original version of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, where there's the barroom brawl, they used Irish fiddle music as well.
It's like, for a while, the go-to music for a brawl was banjo music, and then it was like they were like, let's retire the banjo, lift it up into the rafters, we'll bring down the Irish fiddle, and then someday they'll retire that and they'll bring in like an accordion or a hammer
dulcimer.
Yeah, a hammer dulcimer. They'll bring just a snare drum. That'll be the new brawl music.
Yes, hot snare, some hi-hat.
It also is used for chase scenes.
But then there were a couple of murders
The Mask of the Red Death, no actual murder.
What were they? Like, lesser known stories? Is that what?
Well, there's one that's based on, that makes reference to Casca the Amontillado, where But before that, there's a story called The Case of M. Voldemar.
Right.
Where a character is in half, he's not dead yet, but it's through some kind of like hypnosis. He is halfway between life and death, and he can still speak.
Okay.
And they kind of reference that by having the serial killer leave a cutout tongue for Edgar Allan Poe to find.
Yeah.
Then they find. Then there's the Mask of the Casca di Amontillado.
Yeah.
And are there other ones?
I don't know. I think that
I
might
can't
be.
Can't remember
it.
If there are any more murders.
Expecting there to be like a Hop Frog one where they cover someone in pitch and put feathers on them.
And they don't really do a Telltale Heart one necessarily, except that. It turns out she's buried under the floor, you know.
Yeah. So, Poe.
Yeah.
Poe stories.
Poe stories, what are you going to do? It's still entertaining as entertaining today as they were 160 years ago.
Yeah, if anything, the movie reminded us of something we liked.
That's true. It was like a, at times it was like a weak retread of like From Hell, but at other times it was like, oh yeah, this does remind me of Edgar Allan Poe.
Yep.
I mean, like that.
We were a little disappointed because in the first scene, I would describe. I said that John Cusack's performance was kind of like Nicolas Cage doing Robert Downey Jr. in the Sherlock Holmes movies. Like it was at that pitch,
very high pitch.
Later on, it calmed down, and I was disappointed that it calmed down to the degree that it did.
Yeah, it's too bad because it's probably in some to really get a good Poe, he should have been swinging wildly between manic and depressive, like really quiet and calm down and sad, and then like yelling at people and drunk. Like that would have been more fun. Not in real life, obviously. Poe was a handful, very hard to deal with. But
I had the stories I could tell you about Poe.
Oh, me and Poe. The times I had with Poe, me and EAP, but I used to call him Wyatt Eep. But
okay. When would he call him that? Like at dinners and
yeah, like if I was if I called him up on his phone.
I understand.
We had those Nextels, so it was like chirp chirp, Wyatt Eep, where you at? And then he'd say, "Good friend, I am at the liquor house. I'll meet you there. I'll meet you there, Holmes."
Poe has become the mayor of the liquor house.
Yeah, he was big on Foursquare.
Yep.
But for most of the movie, Edgar Allan Poe. For most of the movie, John Cusack is just really
He became transformed.
It's like a more mannered Lloyd Dobler in a goatee. Like he's not that exciting or interesting, and he's fairly low energy.
Van Dyke was doing all the acting, is what you're saying?
Yeah, yep. Dick Van Dyke was doing all the acting for him. No, but it did feel like John Cusack did a little bit of like sleepwalking through the movie, you know, which is too bad because that first scene you're like, this is gonna be good. Oh boy, this is Vampire's Kiss level acting.
He was gonna be the splash of color in an otherwise completely drab movie.
Otherwise very drab movie.
Because I love Brendan Gleeson. He's boring except for his wacky accent every once in a while. Luke Evans, just like in Three Musketeers, is basically a cardboard cutout.
Yeah, the
girl
that
lady was pretty, but she was stuck in a box most of the movie.
And while I do like pretty ladies stuck in boxes,
Boxing Helena is your favorite movie.
Yeah.
But mostly because you think it's about Helen of Troy becoming a boxer, which it's not. You've seen it many times.
But every time I trick myself.
Maybe this time.
How can they punch that beautiful face?
That's how she wins.
But yeah, everyone's at that low level of non-energy that you find in a lot of movies nowadays, where it's like, it feels like more like, look, we've got the concept, let's just go through the motions, and we'll be done with it. And there are a couple of neat, there are a couple of images in the movie I actually kind of liked. They find a body that has its mouth sewn up, and they have to cut the threads, and then they pull a pocket watch out, and the pocket watch's hands are set to like a longitude that is on a map somewhere.
Sure.
But I like that image of them pulling the watch out of the corpse's mouth. And then at one point, the fiance is buried alive in a coffin, but there's like a hole in the wood. She's managed to dig a little bit of the dirt out, and the kidnapper puts his mouth up to the hole and is just kind of like whispering something, but you can't, at least with on Dan's TV, I couldn't quite make out what it was. And there's something very creepy about just this disembodied mouth just whispering something incomprehensible from the other side of a wall.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, like those brief moments are not borne aloft by the structure betwixt them.
Yeah, I mean, like this movie, it puts together a lot of things that I find irritating in modern movie, which is the juxtaposition of the modern and the old, and the idea of like, let's take a figure that existed, you know, Abraham Lincoln vampire hunter style, and sure, stick him in this adventure, and like, let's have a serial killer who has all these basically magical powers to predict what's going to happen, and unlimited resources to set up his little cat and mouse game.
Yeah, he's not just two steps ahead of the police. He's like 80 steps ahead of the police, like, at every point.
Any one of those things is a cliche, but could be forgivable in a movie if the movie is good otherwise. But when you put them all together, you've created a movie that only exists in movie world.
Yeah, but let's look at some of the positives. A lot of funny hats, a lot of funny mustaches.
Yeah, especially the fire chief.
Mm-hmm.
Chief Fire Inspector.
He had those mutton chop mustache.
Like, he's daring the fire to burn him off.
There's a part where John Cusack's house is burned down by the killer. And yeah, and there's a fire chief who has a big mustache.
What I like is that his raccoon clearly survives the blaze, and I would have liked to see that story, how the raccoon escapes.
Well, that's the other thing is, Edgar Allan Poe basically moves in with the police detective because his house is burned down, brings his cage with a raccoon in it, and we never see like a scene of the detective frustrated with his new messy roommate, having to deal with like detective waking up in bed, there's a raccoon on his face. Like, they, you know, play up the odd coupleness.
Does the detective own that raccoon now? Is that
you have a trained raccoon?
I think that's Baltimore law, yeah.
Now that he's dead.
You have a trained raccoon. You gotta use it. That's gold. That's green gold.
That's movie gold. Just like the hit film Over the Hedge. One of the few movies about a raccoon. But yeah, I think
one thing, what was happening when the screenwriters were like, let's give Poe a raccoon.
It's possible. I wonder if...
Was that a real thing?
I don't remember. I don't know. Maybe, like, he did have a pet raccoon. I don't remember.
Elliot's brother David, email us and tell us whether or not those are real thing.
The Baltimore Ravens are named after Edgar Allan Poe's poem, so maybe my brother knows what, if he had a pet raccoon. But it does seem like a weird thing to do to like humanize Edgar Allan Poe by giving him this silly pet and then not doing anything with it. Mm-hmm. Like having the raccoon go, huh? When something crazy happens.
Yeah. Bandit. Find Elizabeth. Find him.
I would have loved that.
Sniff her out, girl.
I don't think his name was Bandit.
I just assume all raccoons.
That's the name of the raccoon in King of the Hill, I think.
Because they look like little bandits.
Yeah.
Because they've got a mask, yeah.
Little mask, maybe a handkerchief around its neck.
Mm-hmm. That's the way raccoons always accessorize. Dangly earring, maybe a bouffant wig.
We got a six-shooter. Pearl-handed six-shooter.
I like this cross-dressing cool raccoon we got.
Maybe Rocket Raccoon or whatever.
What?
Isn't that your superhero?
No, Rocket Raccoon is a Marvel superhero character. Yeah, yeah. Okay. He'll be in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie in theaters 2015.
I confuse him with Rocket Crocodile.
You confuse him with Rocket Crocodile in the World of Tomorrow. The hit film that features mainly just Carla Gugino and Gina Gershon nude, but also it's the future.
It seems weird because like, the title would suggest a children's movie.
No, it is not.
There is explicit nudity.
Was Sky Captain a children's movie? No.
Explicit nudity, and I assume lesbian themes.
Oh, I mean, they go beyond themes. It's not subtext, it's text.
Yeah, it's like that Femalian where they trick kids like aliens.
Yeah, people love aliens. They love kids love females.
Femalian? This will be a good this will be a good role model for the females, the female kids
who want to be aliens. female kids. There's some, I don't know if there's a word for a female kid, but for those.
Boils and female kids.
Girls who want to grow up to be aliens, is what I'm saying. You know.
Look, we can't be species. Let species be the only role model for them. Not a positive role model.
Also, a very breast-based female alien species.
Wait, what?
Have you ever seen a female alien in a movie that didn't have breasts? Come on, these are for...
You got Life Force, too, also very nude.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think all I don't know why
this just turned into Dan's catalog of nude female aliens.
I wasn't the guy who mentioned species.
You brought up Rocket Crocodile.
Of course. I brought up Rocket Crocodile, so it's my fault we're now talking about nude female aliens.
I was talking about species more because Species 2 is really weird, where the male species goes around and keeps banging chicks, and they immediately explode with a baby. Yeah. It's really gross.
That was super trying to fucked even up. the gender
it's
scales.
Totally unfair. It's super fucked up and gross.
Well, so Species 2 was the movie we watched. So I guess what we're saying is The Raven 2, more raccoon.
Yeah, of
less
course.
Police inspector, more raccoon.
I mean, anything that has a raccoon and a police inspector in it, that's the note I would give.
Is more raccoon?
Yeah.
What if the raccoon was the police inspector?
Brilliant. Can I write you a check for $1 million right now?
I'm not stopping you.
Okay. You might want to wait about 100 years. 100 years to cash it.
I'm going to post-date this check to after the heat death of the universe. But then go ahead and cash it. And spend it on whatever thing with no energy there is left in the universe.
Spend it on, I don't know, dark matter?
That's going to be very cheap at the time. I can buy a lot of dark matter.
So that's so probably...
Raccoons? Oh, here's the thing I'll mention. Okay. I will give it this. It's more...
It was a movie.
It's a movie.
That was filmed.
It is more based on...
It wasn't 2 hours longer. It wasn't longer than 2 hours.
It was slightly shorter than 2 hours. It justifies its connection to Edgar Allan Poe much better than the 30s movie The Raven, which stars Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff. And Bela Lugosi is just a mad killer who likes Edgar Allan Poe, but doesn't like – he just happens to talk about how much he likes Edgar Allan Poe. Otherwise, it's not connected. But that movie, better than this one. So I don't know what to tell you.
I think it's time to give our final judgments on The Raven. Is this a good bet? Wait, hold on.
What?
It's Shocktober, Dan.
It's Shocktober.
Hold on. What are you doing with these other 11 months of the year ratings that you're about to go into?
Start all the way over.
Shocktober. So we have to say if it's spookily good, bad, scarily horrifying.
No, I've got the Shocktober categories.
If it's frighteningly farty.
Was this movie?
Frighteningly farty?
Yeah, totally scarifying.
Okay, scarifying.
Was it frighteningly funny? Or was it totally snorifying?
Every movie fits into one of those three categories.
Every movie ever made in history.
I'm gonna have to say Casablanca was totally scarifying. And I think I'm gonna say let's see. Well, Schindler's List wasn't really frighteningly funny.
But it was spookily good bad.
Spookily good bad.
No.
Horrifyingly not so good.
Totally scarifying. Frighteningly funny.
Or nightmarishly.
Or
eh.
Totally snorifying. Which
Stuart,
one?
Stuart, you go foist.
Man, I'm on the spot. I'm going to say snorifying. That's one of them, right?
Yeah, that's
one. He just said it.
It was super snorifying. I mean, there was no life in this movie. And all the blood was CGI, and there weren't enough babes. So not enough blood, not enough babes.
That's two B's that we're missing for Stuart.
I'm going to say that, like, for me...
What's weird is Stuart's other B is bagels.
Yeah.
Which is optional.
For me, this was two-thirds snorifying, one-third scarifying. Because I got to say, like, I'm grading this on the Flophouse curve, which we've watched so many movies that any small piece of joy is amplified. But I wasn't bored by this movie the way I normally am by movies we watch. I thought that it had certain qualities that were enjoyable. I liked some of the Poe references. I thought that the direction was not bad. But by and large, it was pretty stupid.
I think I'm going to give it not one-third to two-third, but maybe 90% snorifying, 10% scarifying, if I can mix it that way. Like, yeah, it wasn't – it was not – it was pretty lifeless and stilted and uninspired, but it was like entertaining in fits and starts, and it passed the time a little better than some of the other garbage that we've watched for this podcast.
And we haven't even brought this up, but this is probably the most Nicolas Cagey role not played by a non-Nicolas Cage.
It's a missed opportunity. If that had been Nicolas Cage in that movie, it would instantly rocket up to at least frighteningly funny, if not totally scarifying.
Because John Cusack, like, Lord love him, but he can't bring the crazy.
He doesn't have the energy. That's part of the problem. He's great for a movie like Gross Point Blank, where he's kind of a laid-back character.
Sure.
But for a movie like
When he was the High Fidelity guy.
His name was High, H-Y Fidelity.
Sure.
Chaim Fidelity.
Oh, God. I didn't know he was Jewish.
Yeah, Fidelowitz. They changed to Ellis Island when they bought a record store.
So this is the bit where we talk about new possible bits, right?
This is the part of the
podcast. Actually, I have a great idea for a new bit. It's called If This Movie Was Starring Clowns, and we talk about how would the movie be different if clowns were the stars?
Like professional clowns?
The best professional clowns. Emmett
probably
Kelly.
Probably French, right?
What?
They'd probably be French.
Some of them.
Right?
I mean, Marcel Marceau, if you consider him a clown, miming is kind of a different art than clowning.
Okay, thanks.
That guy who's with the Ringling Brothers Circus, I think his name is Balto or Beppo or something. So how would this movie be different if it was clowns? Probably funnier, right?
That's a good bit. I was going to pitch a bit where we just play the movie, specific scenes, and we remember parts of the movie. We go, remember that part? You know, the audience would really get a kick out
they
of us remembering
that.
The things we just saw.
Because they'd remember it through us.
Because you know what? I forget half this shit when we do these things. Like,
yeah, we can
I'm
tell.
Drinking and checking my phone the whole time, so I don't really know what's going on.
I'm
going
to pitch a bit where what we do next is we read letters from listeners and we react to them.
That one's all right, but what about this? It's a bit called If John Cusack Was a Bear.
Okay.
Imagine the scene in Say Anything where he holds up the boombox if a bear had been doing it. Frightening. They would have shot him. If only to save the life of the boombox.
This letter is titled...
Oh, are we on the letters segment now?
Yeah, we are. This letter is titled Wushu / John Hurt, and it's from Kevin, last name withheld. He says, Dear Flophouse, I just started listening and I love the show. However, two topics keep coming up.
Wushu and John Hurt.
John Hurt, parentheses, Spaceballs, and Wushu Fire.
Best known for his cameo in Spaceballs. That's a reference to another movie he's in.
Sir John Hurt of Spaceballs.
Sir John Hurt, for your excellent work in Spaceballs, I make thee a knight of the realm. Arise, Sir John Hurt.
And Wushu Fire.
Arise, Sir Spaceballs.
John Hurt, and Wushu Fighting, parentheses, the Three Musketeers. Since I was so disappointed with the finale of The Lost Experience, I'm excited to see that you are giving us these clues to follow to find out the answers to Flophouse mysteries you won't have time to address on the show proper.
Yep, and orangutan will be involved,
too. John Hurt plus Wushu Fighting clearly has something to do with V for Vendetta, but I don't know how that connects to Flophouse. I wait the next clue. That's from Kevin Lastner.
Well, this movie, The Raven, was directed by the man who directed V for Vendetta.
James McTeague, yeah.
So put that puzzle piece in the puzzle box.
So if you want to build an empire of turds, he's doing a pretty good job, right?
Yes. If you want to make a series of stilted, slow, boring movies that are should be much more exciting and much faster
and
paced.
And shittier than their source material.
Yeah. I mean, the source material for this would be what, like all the works of Edgar Allan Poe?
Yeah, probably, right?
Yeah, I guess so. It'd be hard to make a movie as good as that.
Go on.
Numero dos.
This letter is titled Sight and Soundless plus Emmys. It's from Michael, last name withheld.
Hey, Michael, thanks for writing in.
Hey, man.
He said, I was wondering what your guys' take was on Vertigo topping Citizen Kane on the Sight and Sound list. Also, as a Flophouse superfan, I'd like to wish you guys luck in the Emmys, although it seems you won't need much luck. The Daily Show seems to own that category yearly.
Well, I want to say thank you for the luck. I'm still working on Miami. I haven't got it yet. Yeah. But, you know, I'm
you
fucking
will.
Due at this point.
You
right?
will. And this letter obviously predates our Emmy wins.
Yeah. I wanted to mention that in part because...
it took a long time to ship. Postage was rough. Sure. I don't know where to come from.
I just want to call out to some folks who were saying that they didn't see us on the Emmys or they thought they saw us on the Emmys.
Yeah, we were not
mistaken.
There.
We were not at the primetime Emmys. The our writing category was in the Creative Arts, non televised this year.
Well, it was televised on the Reels channel.
On the Reels channel, that if you get a premium movie package, you might have reels.
It might get bundled in. Our category was not in the Primetime Emmys this year due to a agreement between our union and the producers of the Emmys that we won't get into right now. But regardless, I can say it is a stupid agreement that I don't support.
Wow. Wow.
Specials writers. But thank you for the congratulations. We had a lot of fun. Dan won his first Emmy and got a little bit of press about it.
Yeah, it was in Daily Variety.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
Daily Variety.
It's right over there. And I'm trying to think if there's any exciting... And we passed by Mindy Kaling on the plane as we walked on with our Emmys.
That's pretty exciting.
And she tweeted about us.
Yeah. Star of the Mindy Project.
Among other things, yeah.
But, I mean, best known for that, though, right?
Well, she will be 10 seasons from now.
More importantly, though, this Sight and Sound question.
Well, I will point people, if I can take a moment, to the Flophouse Facebook page, where there was quite a back-and-forth discussion of the Sight and Sound list.
About hamburgers and steaks?
No, it was not a hamburger and steaks discussion.
Whether the hamburger or the steak should top the Sight and Sound list for best piece of meat.
Stop the... but we had a long discussion about it that I thought was very helpful for anyone who's interested in it. But I will say, speaking for myself, I have no problem at all with Vertigo topping the list. I love Citizen Kane. I love Vertigo. They're both great. Vertigo is almost as perfect as a movie can get, in my opinion. It's just beautiful in almost every way, and haunting as well, in a way that you would not be able to do the same story quite as well in another medium.
I mean, they both do different things. I mean, I think that Vertigo might have like a little more unity as a film, and it has this weird swell of a romantic emotion, but Citizen Kane takes advantage of all the components of being a film in a way
except for CGI 3D effects.
Sure. In a way that was obviously very new.
Someday. Yeah. Someday we'll get there.
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, there was Citizen Kane Special Edition when there's more little robots floating around. No, they're both amazing movies, but like, there are some movies that if they had become the number, like, Tokyo Story is a very good movie, but if that had been made number one, and that's always a Sight and Sound top 10 list favorite, I would have been very surprised and not agree with it. But Vertigo, it's hard to take issue with. It's just a beautiful movie. I've seen it, I don't know how many times now, many double digits, and each time it's just like rapturous. So,
yeah, what you guys said. I mean, you guys all know my stance on movies.
Yeah, I know.
Castle Freak,
Invisible Maniac, Head of the Family.
Which one of those is the best?
Big Trouble in Little China.
That's for the gods. That's for the gods to decide.
I would love if Sight and
Sound
contacted just Stuart to submit his top 10 list, and that was like just the vote needed to nudge Invisible Maniac into the top 10. Sorry, rules of the game, you fell out. Invisible Maniac is in.
We'd finally learn which had the greater part in Stuart's heart, though, Castle Freak or The Invisible Maniac.
He would just write them all in at number one.
this letter is titled Theme Songs from Lawrence Last Name Withheld.
Olivier.
Probably a request to sing one, Ellie.
I would think so. Flophouse time, it's Flophouse time. Don't commit a crime, because it's Flophouse time. Wait till it's over, then commit that crime.
Wait,
cut us in for a half of the take. We'll provide an alibi, Flophouse. Just say you were listening to the Flophouse.
Wait, we're recording
the
this.
Judge will let you off the charges. But again, give us half. Make
we're
that 60%.
Leaving
Flophouse time
right
tonight.
Wow, that's a lot.
You're recording this as evidence.
Not evidence.
This.
I wasn't even here. I've got an alibi.
He writes, Dear Autocrators Flopricanicus, I recently became addicted to your podcast and buzzsawed my way through your back catalog in about a week. However, I have one complaint.
5 years of work in 1 week.
Although your podcast itself has a fairly jaunty theme, the individual floppers don't have their own theme songs.
Whoa!
Depriving
opening
you
up Pandora's box, are you, Lawrence?
Guitar, cue guitar squeal, Dan. Come on.
Depriving you of a valuable opportunity for some WWF-style showmanship as you triumphantly enter the room, run around the edges of the table, working the crowd, then triumphantly take your seats before your microphones. Here are my suggestions.
I will mention the crowd you're referring to is Dan's cat, who would really like it if we would just shut up and not bother her.
She would be confused. She usually runs out of the room if we're watching a movie that's too loud. But he says, here are my suggestions and their justifications. Dan, Godzilla's theme.
Love it. Yes.
The best flopper.
The
best flopper gets the best song.
What?
A testament.
Somebody wrote that into the letter, I guess.
Yeah.
A testament to His Majesty, determination, and immense destructive power.
It's true.
Elliot.
And your breath certainly is radioactive.
Elliot.
High five.
Mommy, can I go out and kill tonight? And
love it. Love it.
Because of his reedy voice and obsessive nature that remind me of a serial killer.
Wait a minute.
Stewart, right. Turbo Lover by Judas Priest.
Love it. These are all great choices.
In honor of Naked Sundays and his reportedly enormous penis. The Flophouse House Cat, Party All Night by Quiet Riot.
Not a fan.
This one is so obvious it doesn't require an explanation. I hope this keeps up the energy levels and creates a closer bond between you and your fans. Yours, Lawrence, last name with hell.
Well, those are all mostly good choices.
How come when the idea of a theme song for Dan came to me, I immediately was thinking of like the sound of one of like a Peanuts teacher talking, like an adult, like, wah, 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 wah.
I mean, that's not a song, but yeah, that's kind of what it sounds
like. I mean, it's
like.
Musical, though.
I mean, the instrumental of Christmas Time Is Here would not be bad. It would capture my melancholy.
Yeah, that, what the, do, 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 yeah, do, sure. Do, that one. I think,
but that's not really. You can't run around Dan's living room dancing to that.
He would gesticulating, shuffle around and just looking at the floor, moping about,
gesticulating in front of the cat.
I think maybe fish heads would work for you, Dan.
What about the title theme from Big Trouble in Little China?
Big Trouble. We run.
I think you're wishing
into
on a star
the mystic
right now.
Night. It's pretty good. I gotta say, those are pretty good choices.
Yeah, I think if the next time you wanted to choose something for yourselves, rather, I mean, like, these are all good choices, but I have to open it up. If you wanted to choose,
I would
something
say some
else.
like classy jazz or something for Elliot.
I would want either Exciter by Judas Priest,
sure,
or
Ace of Spades,
or Ace of Spades by Motorhead, pretty much, or the theme song I used to use when I used to do a one man show in the city a couple times a month was the Quantum Leap theme. And I would act pretty out my good. Emotions during the song.
It's pretty good.
But Ace of Spades would be pretty sweet.
I mean, for me, anything like just give me some Eddie Van Halen noodling and a guitar, something I can do some karate kicks to.
Sure.
Something I can like try and tear at my clothing.
I mean, Turbo Lover would be pretty good for that.
Turbo, yeah, yeah. I mean,
it takes a little bit to start up.
Tough to mess with success, you know.
And Dan, what would you like besides the Peanuts theme or the Peanuts Christmas time theme?
Or the Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, right, Big Trouble in Little China.
I think we've covered it. Do you want to go again? I mean,
we just keep around to it.
I think maybe the Ninja Turtles theme. Sure. Instead of turtles, they say Elliot.
Yeah, just me, Mr. Belvedere theme, you know.
And I think for Dan, the two of us, you and me, Stuart, would do an a cappella version of the Saved by the Bell theme.
Yeah.
Or maybe my two dads. I think when we do a live show, we have to enter to these songs now.
I think that's a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, we should plug our live show.
Yeah, November 2nd, I believe.
November 2nd.
Friday night, 8 p.m., 92 I
Friday
Tribeca.
Friday night in New York City, New York.
New York City, New York, Manhattan, 92 I Tribeca, 200 Hudson Street. Us, the I Love Bad Movies crew,
it's
will
like
be showing you
right?
The movie Bratz. You've heard about it. You've seen about it. Mm-hmm. You've smelled about it. You've loved about it. Bratz, the movie that is the apex of Flophouse movie ratings, although Journey to the Center of the Mysterious
good, yeah.
Magnificent Island is pretty good. But yeah, we'll be showing Bratz with commentary by us, presentation by Matt Xenia from I Love Bad Movies, Mewvies, and
Meowvies.
Meowvies. And it'll be 8 o'clock Friday, November 2nd.
So
letter, don't tell any paparazzos.
Yeah.
Just you come. Don't bring
the
paparazzos.
Paparazzo is paparazzi.
It's paparazziti. And also, if this is this coming up, is this being put up this weekend? This episode?
Yes.
Then you'll have one more chance to see my sketch show at 92 I Tribeca Thursday, October 18th, with special guest Al Madrigal, 9 p.m.
Enemy guest.
Letter is titled IMDb Notes for Castle Freak.
Oh, okay.
Matt, last name withheld. He says, hey, floppers.
Hey, Matt.
On IMDb, under the Parents Guide page, the only mention of the titular Castle Freak and his junk is as follows. There's a full frontal male nudity from the Castle Freak throughout the final third of the movie, although it's all fake and he has no penis. I was unaware that there needed to be a delineation between the nudity being fake and the freak has no penis, but these are the rules
well,
the IMDb governs
by. Why
don't you
hire a guy with no penis to play the part?
Also, under the frightening/intense scenes tab, there is this other gem. A character is blind, and there are several scenes when she is unaware that the castle freak is in the same room as her. Somehow the intensity of the scene isn't given justice by this IMDb description.
I mean, that just sounds like horror movie
last name withheld.
So nothing about Ding Dong ripping.
I think my original comment stands.
Well, to that point, I would like to read our last letter of the night.
Oh, this is the Castle Freak debate continue?
It's from Jordan, last name with help.
Oh, Jordan
it's
is going to step into
Stuart
Freak
Gordon, game. Last name with help.
Stuart Gordon, last name. Dear Flophouse. I know there is no ding-dong ripping scene, but I can't believe Stuart guessed my intention. Unfortunately, the scene was cut from the original script due to budget considerations. We could not afford the ding-dong prosthetic. That would be ripped off in place of his real
ding-dong.
Sometimes
I wish my parents had named me after Stuart Gordon, even though there's no way they would have.
No.
Sometimes I wish my parents had named me Ding-Dong Prosthetic. this last letter of the evening is titled Ding-Dong Gate.
Okay. Yep.
It says, Dear Floppers, I was horrified to hear about Ding-Dong Gate while listening to the Passion Play episode of the Flophouse, so I took it upon myself to help redeem Stuart by delving into my own collection of horrible VHS movies from the 80s and unearthed Night of the Demon, a god-awful film about Bigfoot killing a bunch of hapless idiots in plaid shirts. Luckily for Stuart, Night of the Demon contains one scene where Bigfoot rips off a biker's ding-dong as he is urinating on a bush, so now Stuart can recommend Night of the Demon as his go-to ding-dong ripping film choice.
I don't think it's the same. He's got to rip off his own ding-dong.
Just to confirm what I've said, I've included a link to the aforementioned scene. I'll put that up on the site.
Please do.
Love the show. Great work. Warmest regards, Jordan, last name withheld.
Thanks, now, Jordan.
I read that just to dispel a myth that we are specifically seeking out
Ding Dong movies?
Ding Dong ripping.
Because I'm sure there's any number of South Korean or Japanese movies we could watch.
I'm pretty sure in Street Trash there's a scene where Ding Dong gets ripped off and they play keep away with
it. And of course there's the immortal scene in Snakes on a Plane where the snake bites the guy's Ding Dong and he delivers the best line in cinema history.
But this,
get off my dick!
But this myth that we are somehow cataloging
like
Ding Dong rippings and only giving our highest ratings to films.
Well, not
Ding
us, just Stuart.
Yeah, just me.
Yeah,
I think
I take the blame.
But I think it's Stuart is so confident in his own ding-dong that he can enjoy a scene of a ding-dong being ripped off where many men would find it painful
to
watch.
He has no castration anxiety is what you're saying.
Nope, because Stuart has multiple penises.
My ding-dong would bite that snake back if it attacked me, even if it was like a cobra or, I don't know, a manaconda.
Or a cobra commander, even.
A manaconda.
Manaconda. I thought that was what you called yours.
No, I don't call it that at all. So... yeah, I mean, we're not – our podcast is not some kind of a like repository for clips of movies where penises get torn off of bodies, nor is it a place where you should send your slash fiction featuring us.
So that's two things this podcast is not, but otherwise it's everything.
We appreciate the former. We don't necessarily appreciate
the
latter.
I appreciate
the
effort that goes into the
latter. If you want to write fan fiction about us, have us like be doing just cool stuff, like
stopping a serial killer. Being friends and just hanging out.
Maybe we're just like skateboarding around, solving crime.
Yeah,
like
there was protecting a rec center from an evil zombie overlord.
Yeah, or there was one time that Stuart and Dan and I had sex. Just write a story
about that.
Oh, is that the type you were talking? Oh, that's right. Yeah. Or have a story where we go travel in time and meet our favorite historical figures.
It cheapens the sex we had. It cheapens it, Elliot.
To air our dirty laundry that way.
Sure.
Why no Flophouse and space stories? Why no Flophouse in the time of the pharaohs stories?
What about the Flophouse rock band that we have?
Yeah, come on. What if Penny met the Flophouse?
I love all these ideas.
The question's been asked. Who's going to provide the stories? Who will tell these stories to our children?
Mm-hmm. Some kind of an oral tradition, I would hope.
I want to see a Flophouse story with an ironic O. Henry-esque ending.
Yeah.
How about this? In honor of this
movie, your
the Owl Creek Bridge did it all along.
It was the Owl Creek Bridge that done it. One more thing, Owl Creek Bridge. You said that the man escaped and made it back to his wife, but isn't that the man dangling from you right now? Case closed. Columbo solved the case of the Owl Creek Bridge murders. Ambrose Bierce, take him away.
He's like the duty officer or something.
So how about in honor of this movie, if anyone wants to write Flophouse fan fiction, maybe we're in a macabre Edgar Allan Poe style story. I think everyone here would be more comfortable with a story where we died than a story where we had sex with each other.
And leave all the sex as subtext.
Yes.
So this is the part of the podcast where we talk about good movies that we've seen.
I thought you were still talking about Ding Dong Ripping.
Oh, no. The Ding Dong Ripping is done.
The Ding Dong Ripper. He struck again.
Is that a new character you're working on? Or?
Yeah, yeah. He's called Jack Off the Ripper.
Just workshop.
It's for my one-man show about the neighborhood I grew up in, where I play seven different neighborhood characters.
They all have different accents. It's crazy. So cosmopolitan.
And this is part of the show
where we talk
about movies that we would like to recommend. Rather than tear down, we want to build up. Stuart, is there a film that you saw recently that you'd like to discuss?
I watched a shitload of movies lately. I saw Looper, which was great, and is getting a lot of good press, so it doesn't need me to stand up for it. Looper, that's the time travel action movie with Bruce Willis and Joseph
Ryan Johnson directed.
Toucan Sam goes back in time for Looper. Yeah,
it's good. But I was going to recommend a movie called The Tall Man, a Jessica Biel starring horror thriller, which you immediately think, that sounds terrible.
Well, I think it sounds like a Phantasm movie.
That's the thing. Like, everybody knows I'm a fan of tall men in their various forms. But it's a horror movie set in the Pacific Northwest, and it is by a director who directed Martyrs, which is a French
ultra gore movie.
Yeah, and it's hard to really talk about the movie too much without kind of talking about a relatively important twist to it. But
he turns out he's short.
That's the thing. You would never have guessed it. But I think, as other reviewers have said, this is easily the best performance you're ever going to see of Jessica Biel, and not that many people are going to see it. But it's great. It's very atmospheric, and I recommend it. The Tall Man.
I saw two movies that I enjoyed fairly well recently. I watched Wanderlust, which was written by Ken Marino and David Wayne, and directed by David Wayne.
He loves those guys.
I like them. I like the skate guys.
Starred Paul Rudd and Jennifer Aniston. Ooh, you got a bunch of...
Deal breaker.
Which one?
All of them.
You don't like Paul Rudd?
No, he's fine. And Jennifer Aniston's fine.
And it's got...
I guess the deal wasn't broken.
It's got a lot of, supporting actors that you know from comedy. You got your Joe Latruglio.
Also The State.
Also, Ken Marino has a small part in it.
State.
Carrie Kinney.
State.
Also from The State. Malin Ackerman.
Watchmen.
Alan Alda is in it.
The State.
Kean Peele have parts in it.
Kean Peele.
Lauren Ambrose.
The State.
Anyway, she was not. But it's a movie that loses its way a little bit in the middle. Like, once it starts getting into...
It wanders a little.
Well, once it starts getting into plot machinations, it gets a little less interesting. The first 30 minutes of it, I was convinced I was watching, you know, a really great comedy that had just somehow slipped through the cracks, like the way that Wet Hot American Summer got a bunch of bad reviews when it came out, but was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the first 30 minutes are really good, and then the rest of it is just an acceptable comedy, but it's a lot of fun. It's better than the mediocre reviews would suggest. If you like The State people at all, I would suggest checking it out. And I also actually saw Dread, and I was surprised to find that I enjoyed that movie.
Not surprised at all.
It felt like a bit of an early John Carpenter movie, or maybe a Walter Hill film. It was just a solid, straight ahead science fiction action film that the advantage of it was it kept the focus very small. It was about Judge Dredd and his trainee being trapped.
Judge Judy.
Yes. Being trapped in this one building and having to make their way through the floors of that building.
A la The Raid : Redemption.
Yeah, I hear it's a very similar plot line, but keeping the focus very small, I think, made it into a focused science fiction B-movie, the kind that you don't necessarily see that
much. As opposed
much.
To the Judge Dredd Sylvester Stallone movie, which is like a sprawling, overblown type of thing.
Yeah.
A beautiful epic.
So I enjoyed both of those movies.
It's a Chronicle of Riddick.
Liked them both.
You know what? I'll continue the theme of recommending two movies, but I'll do it quick. One is if The Raven has interested you in seeing a an Edgar Allan Poe-related movie, don't go see The Raven. Instead, I would recommend The Mask of the Red Death, the Roger Corman-Vincent Price film. I would go out on the limb and say the best of Roger Corman's movies. I'd maybe put it up there. I'd maybe tie it with Bucket of Blood, in my opinion, and the best of the Edgar Allan Poe movies they made together by far. There are times when it reaches a sort of poetic beauty, and there are also some really ridiculous moments that are stupid, that are kind of fun. But overall, it's really good, and embedded in the movie is an adaptation of Hop Frog, the story Dan was hoping to see in The Raven but didn't. So The Mask of the Red Death with Vincent Price, I would very highly recommend. And also, I just saw this past week a classic of world cinema that had passed me by for some reason, Herzog's Aguirre, The Wrath of God, which I realized I had never actually seen. So I watched it, and it was really good. I liked it a lot, and I like The Mask of the Red Death a lot, so I'd recommend both of those.
So, guys, Shocktober, halfway done.
That's too soon.
And we halfway done it with The Raven.
Man, I want to see some fucking ghosts or some, like, backwoods cannibals or something
scary
next
stuff.
Time. Come on.
Let's do some scary movie next
time. Enough of this highbrow shit, you know?
Like The Raven. Enough of this highbrow garbage like Edgar Allan Poe stopping a serial killer.
All right, well, let's just stay tuned till next time. Maybe you'll be totally scarified.
Are you
holding out hope? And I don't know if you're hitting on me, but I guess I'm cool with it.
Whatever, man. If so, the answer's yes. So, well, until next time, I've been Dan McCoy.
And I've been Stuart Wellington.
And I've been Elliot totally scarifying Kalen, but not really scarifying. Just, you know, friendly, pleasant, nice to be around. Mm-hmm. Don't be scared. Please, don't run. No, no, this hideous visage. Oh, separating me from the rest of humanity. God damn them all. I'll destroy them. There's a bit of acting.
Still part of your one-man show, right?
Yeah. Well, I lived on the same block as a mad scientist with a disfigured face.
Didn't have an accent, though. That was weird.
No, well, I have to workshop the accent. He was also Irish and Australian. A little bit of Japanese in there.
Good night.
Moon blood good then, huh?
Good fright, Dan. Good fright.
Yeah, so you guys are gonna be there for the midnight show with me, right?
Don't think so.
You fucking turds.
I don't know why we're turds, because we're not gonna go see The Hobbit at midnight with you.
It's gonna be super fun. We're gonna wear our PJs and get in line.
Wine?
No, we're getting in line.
I mean, we can get PJs. Wine too, dude. If that's the fucking
wine, just put it in, hide it in your PJs.
Yeah, man. So the first thing you do is you take a Gatorade bottle, okay? You pour that shit out, pour it all over the street. Then you fill that shit, you fill the bottle, the plastic bottle, with a bunch of wine. Carlo Rossi, I'd probably recommend, because you can get a shitload of it.
Then what's the drinking game? When do you drink? Whenever you see what, a Hobbit?
No, you just drink it because it's good, and you're watching an awesome movie called The Hobbit. An unexpected journey.